First of all, thank you for the opportunity to share some words. So I happen to be a pack rat. Who are pack rats here in the room? Who won't admit it? Okay. And my wife, thank God, is the opposite. And that's why our house is functional. But I like to save cardboard boxes because they're good boxes. Why should you throw them out? Of course, since we order things from Amazon on a regular basis, we're grandparents, and we buy things for our grandchild. I think that the child has enough clothing to last them for like the next million years in case there's a siege. Okay? We have a lot of boxes. So I'm not sure what to do with all these boxes. What do I have to do with these boxes? Do I have to recycle them? Do I have to reuse them? Can I throw them out? What to do about them? So my wife and I had this discussion, and it reminded me of a story which I once heard about a person who came to a psychologist. And he comes to the psychologist, and the doctor says, "Why are you here?" He says, "I don't know." "Well, there's a reason why you came." He says, "Yes, my family said I had to come." "Why did your family say you had to come?" He says, "I don't know." "Well, what did they say?" "They said that they think I'm crazy." "Okay, why do they think you're crazy?" "It's because, well, I like pancakes." The doctor said, "That's ridiculous. I also like pancakes." "Really? I have thousands stored in my house. Please visit me." So that's what my house looks like. No, so we're not at that situation. Thank God. We have a few boxes that I get to keep. But what do we have to do? Do we have to keep these boxes? Do we not have to keep these boxes? What do we have to do? So does the Torah address this question or not? And as we found many times, as you go through the Torah is going to give an example in one area, and we're going to extrapolate, and we're going to apply to other areas as well. So the Torah gave a paradigmatic example. That's the primary source, and the point of the Torah is to tell me to extrapolate and apply it to other areas as well. The challenge is always going to be is how do you extrapolate it? But first you have to understand the logic behind it, and then you can extrapolate. I can't extrapolate and say, well, since the Torah says don't cut down trees, so therefore anything which grows you shouldn't cut down, you shouldn't cut down wheat. Really? I got to eat. Oh, it's okay to cut down wheat. So what's the primary element that we're looking at? So the Torah does actually have a fascinating mitzvah, which is the mitzvah to not cut down fruit-bearing trees. This example which the Torah talks about is in a scenario of going to war. I am not a major expert in ancient warfare, but they used to use siege weapons. Now, you can either do one of two things. I was supposed to speak English. Schlep is English? Okay. You can schlep those siege weapons with you from wherever you're coming, or you can build them there. Right? Why not build them there? You have good engineers, you build them there. It's much easier than transporting it from where you're coming from. So I'm going to transport these weapons. A lot of effort, energy, waste of time, etc. Let's go there, chop down some trees, build these weapons, make the siege, win the war, and go home with all of the booty, etc. So I come to the city, we come to the city, and we want to build these weapons. We have to cut down trees to build the weapons, okay? So what trees are you allowed to build to cut down? So in your booklet, on page 4, the Torah actually addresses this question. It tells us that if a person goes to the city, or actually page 5 has the English version of it. So you're besieging a city, and you are acting an act of war, belligerence against the city, and you're besieging the city. So Torah says, do not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for from it you will eat. You should not. It's a waste to cut down a fruit-bearing tree. You can eat from it. Is the tree of a field a man? So the Torah is saying this rhetorical question. I know, you can imagine, I wasn't there. All the stories that we read, and I'm old, not that old, okay. All the stories that we read tell us they would come in, they would attack a city, wanton destruction, just destroy everything. Scorched earth, right? Part of the attack, you leave the place a mess. Don't do that. Use the trees, they have fruits. Don't cut them down. Only a tree which you know is not a food tree. So that you're allowed to use. And you build a bulwark against the city, which means the bulwark, I would have said a siege weapon, okay, but they didn't ask me. Until it was conquered. So you're building your weapons. So you have a valid purpose. Now, going to war, you have to understand, going to war, in the Torah version of going to war, requires that they first go to the high court and they judge this question. It requires going to when the high priest was still receiving divine inspiration, you would go to the high priest and you would have to have the high priest agree to it as well. You would then go to the ministers who were considered the very, very good advisors, and they would discuss, does it make sense? So you already had three levels of decision, and this is a just war. It's a justified war, it's a valid war. And even in that context of this valid war, this just war, you have to not do wanton destruction. So we could make an extrapolation that obviously in a scenario where there's no need to destroy something, you should not destroy something. That's all the Torah tells us. We get two verses of the Torah, and this is the source of this mitzvah, which is known in Hebrew as Baal Tashkis, do not destroy. Okay, so far we're good, right? The verse of the Torah tells us not to destroy, not to waste. So what we're going to do in the book like this is the following. The first one, two. Till page 13 are some, no, actually, till page 15, wow. Okay, till page 15. There are various different sources of understanding exactly what is the philosophical underpinnings of this mitzvah, of this commandment. Why is it so bad to cut down this tree? Is it because cutting trees is a bad thing? Trees have a life and you're taking away life? Is that the understanding? So we can only extrapolate to scenarios where you would have something of that sort. So it would be similar to taking the life of an animal for not a valid purpose, cutting a tree for not a valid purpose. But what about if my cardboard box, it's already cut down. I can do whatever I want with my cardboard box. Is that the logic? Is the logic because it's a waste of money? We're Jews. We like money. You know, come on, right? We're Jews, right? So money. Okay, the main thing is money. Why should you waste money? Is that the issue? Is that the understanding? Is understanding the message over here that you have no right to touch anything which belongs to the world, anything in the world, because it's not yours, it's God's. And you need permission. So we have many different ways of looking at this commandment. And each one's going to give us a different starting point to then extrapolate to other scenarios. And that's going to have, where it comes into my world, which is the halachic differences. We're going to come to the Jewish law. We're going to decide these questions. We're going to have to know what the source is. And that's a general rule. Whenever you're trying to extrapolate something from one example, the Torah gave an example. So if the Torah did not tell me that you're allowed to extrapolate, I can't extrapolate. The Torah said this example, and that's it. So there's one commandment, and that's all it is. But Moses was given together with the Torah. He was given rules, principles of how to interpret. And one of the rules is that, yes, the Torah gives mitzvahs as examples, not as just final cases, only case scenario, and that's it. But rather, it's to be understood as an example, and you're supposed to extrapolate. But to do that, we have to know how we're extrapolating, and that's going to be the next few pages. So let's look at some of those. Okay, so I started in no specific order. The first one was the Sefer HaKinuch. Sefer HaKinuch, a little bio I put on the bottom. We're not sure who wrote it. We know that it's from the early Talmud, one of the early works that we have, post-Talmud, in the 1200s, written in Spain. Some say it was written by a person in Barcelona, Rabbi Aaron in Barcelona. We're not sure exactly who it is. What he did is he took the 613 mitzvahs. We know the 613 commandments. And Maimonides makes the list of all the 613, what they are. Now, not everybody agrees with that number. Of course, we're Jews, right? There's two Jews, three opinions. So what exactly are the 613 commandments? Big discussion. Many, many books written on that. But he went and took the Rambam's list of the 613, which the Rambam actually put them in his own order. He didn't follow the order of the Torah. He wrote them in the order which he thought was logical. He divided the positive commandments from the negative commandments. He started with the primary commandments, which are foundational belief issues. And then he went right away into the commandments about the holidays. And then he went from there, he went into all of the mitzvahs that have to do with bringing sacrifices. He found he had his logical order how to present them. So came along the Sefer HaKinuch and said, you know what, I have a better idea. Let's put them in the order that they're found in the Bible. So when you learn a little bit of Chumash in the Bible, you can follow it in order. Actually, he wrote an introduction. He wrote it for his son. His son was a young man and who didn't like listening to when they would read from the Torah. He was bored. So he wrote this book that he should have something to do while it's right. Comic books was one option. They didn't have comic books yet, so they didn't have an option of comic books. So they were left with this sefer instead. So we thank God have the sefer. By the way, I just want to tell you just that Rabbi Tannenbaum told me that I'm speaking to you people. I don't know you. You don't know me. We'll never see each other again, right? So I can let my hair down. My payas keep falling out. So that's my rebellion of the sixties to let your hair down. Okay. I don't have that much to let down, so that's the only place I could do it. Okay. And yes, I'm old enough to say from the rebellion of the 60s, yes. Okay. So the Torah says it's prohibition of cutting down fruit trees. So he understands the root of this commandment, that what he does is he suggests, this is his own understanding, it's not necessarily sourced anybody before him. He looked at the literature which is out there, he came up with an idea, and he feels this is really the logic, this is the message you're supposed to take out of this. He says, the nature of good people is they don't like to waste things. They appreciate the value of what there is in the world. That's the nature of good people. They see the good in everything. Like they say, the same way they see the good in people, they say they see the value in items. They see the value in everything which is there. So therefore, obviously, you're not going to want to destroy something. You're not going to waste it. You're going to use it properly. But the opposite is the people which tend to be destructive and that which expressed an idea that they're willing to hurt other people, they're willing to waste things and destroy things. They get a pleasure out of giving a little kid a toy. What's he going to do with it? Bang it on the ground. See if he can break it. There are some adults which are still in that state of mind. They enjoy the idea of ripping things apart. It's called movies, right? Movies sell. What do they sell? Yeah, violence, excitement, it's destruction. Cars blowing up, buildings falling down, bridges breaking, all those exciting things. It says the nature of good people, they don't enjoy that. I was watching once, why is this entertaining? What exactly is interesting about it? Seeing buildings falling down, okay. Doesn't talk to me, used to when I was a kid. Okay. So that's how he understands it. So this is the message of understanding the value of the items which are in the world. And he doesn't say it belongs to God. He doesn't say because it's not yours. He just says because the nature is you want to value what's here in the world. That's where he starts with. Okay, on page 7, we have a quote over here from the Sefer called Sha'arei Tshuva. Sha'arei Tshuva was one of the first words of ethics. The idea of trying to address Musar, self-improvement, correction, etc. He wrote this work, which is called in the language of the early commentators, the word shari, which means a gate, means a section. Matter of fact, how many of you have touched any Gemara yet? Right? Baba Kama, Baba Metzia, Baba Masa. The word Baba means a gate. What does it mean? It means a gate? What's the gate? That's why sometimes you'll see the introduction page has a picture of a big gate. Right? Why a gate? It means a section. That was the language that they used. So the word Sha'arei Tshuva means he took this and he says, I'm going to address how to repent. Right? So how do you repent? What do you do? So he divides up into 4 sections. The first section is it tells you what are the primary elements, what it means to change yourself. Second section is why you should be motivated to change. The third section is what have you been doing wrong that you need to change? And he makes a list of all of the things. If you really want to become depressed and feel bad about low self-loathing, take this book and read all the list of all the things that you're doing wrong. And yeah, okay, right? So you don't want to do that, right? But we'll take a little bit. One little bit is enough for us. So he lists this commandment, do not destroy, do not take this axe, do not attack this tree, do any of those things. So he says, this is on page 7 at the bottom, you should not destroy the trees by wielding an axe against them. We've been exhorted against cutting down any fruit tree. And we have also been exhorted hereby against spending wastefully even a pruta's worth. Now, a pruta is a very small coin. At the time of them, that was the smallest valuable coin. There was actually a coin smaller than a pruta, but we don't use it because it was the smallest amount which is valuable. Nowadays, what's the value of a pruta? That's a big discussion. 5 cents. Now, I'm old enough to remember when I bought candy bars for 5 cents. Not the little ones. Candy bars for 5 cents. I remember when postage stamps were 3 cents. Okay, so I'm really old. I used to walk a mile, literally, just walk a mile to save myself the nickel of the transfer going to on the school bus. I used to take the city bus to school, and I figured out if I could walk a mile, I could save myself the nickel for the transfer, and I could buy a candy bar. So nowadays, 5 cents, you see it on the ground, you pick it up. Maybe not, depending on the mood, right? Okay, a pruta, something of value. Do not waste. Do not spend wastefully. Now this commandment is like, the way he understands it, a little bit overwhelming. It's based on the Gemara. The Gemara says the following thought. The Gemara says like this. Imagine you have a choice. You go into the store and you can buy, the Gemara gives an example of barley bread and wheat bread. Barley bread is cheaper than wheat bread. So the Gemara says that Faltashis is considered wasting resources to buy the more expensive bread, because you could buy the cheaper bread. The Gemara says, no, that's not true, because wheat bread is better for your body, it's better for your health, and therefore it's not considered wasteful, because you have a valid reason why you're buying the more expensive bread, which would indicate from the Gemara that if they're equal in effect upon the body, they're going to have the same health benefits, you should buy the cheaper one. Because if you buy the more expensive one, you're wasting resources.
Why are they being wasted? The money is going to somebody who's going to use it.
Because when you're given money, it's a question, okay, we're going to try and hold the questions to the end, right? But when the person's given money, he could just spend it on a lot of good things. He buys it, sends it on one thing, and in regards to him, it's been a loss. You're right, somebody else might gain because of it, and that's a good question. But in regards to this person, he could do other good things with it. So I have money. Money is given to me for a purpose to use. I'm not a big believer in saving a lot of money. The purpose of having money is to use it for good things. Part of one of the good things is responsibly making sure you're not going to become a burden on other people. So you should have a retirement account so you can, at some point in time, you will be a burden. That's because it's a responsibility that you have. Save money to make sure that your children have their needs to be able to pay for their college. A good idea. I like seeing that I have a lot of money in my accounts. I just enjoy that. Right? Go back to my pancakes. It's not pancakes, it's dollar bills. Right? I have a lot of dollar bills stored in my house. Is that the same thing as pancakes? No, I mean, people think it isn't. Maybe it is. That's different. That's a different discussion. You'll speak with every title of Mandel that one. But if I can spend them wisely or spend them not wisely, I should spend them wisely. God gave them to me for a reason, to use them as best as I can. So that's like, that blows open our whole society, the consumerism of our society. My nephew told me a story. No, my wife, he went to the boys' camp. Some girls went to the girls' camp. This was 1993, after Glasnost, they started having these Jewish camps for the children in Russia. And he went to Moscow, and these girls went to Moscow. They had a boys' camp, they had a girls' camp. And the girls came back and they told my wife the following. That they were staying in this high-rise building, and there was two high-rise Moscow-style, you've seen the pictures of them, these gigantic high-rise buildings with hundreds and hundreds of apartments inside of them. Two of them next to each other, there was one dumpster in between the two, which was emptied once every 2 weeks. Once every 2 weeks, that's the amount of garbage which was generated between these two gigantic buildings. One dumpster, because it wasn't even a gigantic dumpster, it was like a normal-sized dumpster, it was emptied once every 2 weeks, because they didn't waste anything, they didn't throw anything out. They reused things, they replaced things, they did not throw things out, they did not waste food, they ate the food again and again until it was finished. That was decided. There was poverty there, and that's what they did. That's not our society, right? So the Rabbeinu Yonah is challenging us on that. He's saying that this worker in the Shaarei Teshuva is saying that we're wasting resources. We could maybe spend the money better. That's he understands the mitzvah. Okay. Now the next, page 9, 10, and 11 is an approach from Rabbi Hirsch. And I want to focus on this a little bit. So, Maimonides divides up the commandments into 630 commandments, and he has his division. Rabbi Hirsch divides the mitzvahs into six primary categories. Six primary categories. The first one is called Toros, which means the foundational concepts. And eventually you move from Toros into Mishpatim to take those concepts and apply them into the interface between you and other men. Man to man. Mankind. Then he says the next step is called Chukim, which we know is referred to as the mitzvahs, which you don't understand what they are. And he says that's a misnomer. It's not mitzvahs which have no understanding. It's we don't understand them. Why not? Most of those are commandments vis-a-vis animals, vis-a-vis plants, vis-a-vis the world around us. The reason why we don't understand them is because we have no intuitive understanding of what an animal feels, what the plants feel, what the world feels. We don't understand what that is. It's not intuitive to us. And therefore, from our vantage point, it looks like something which doesn't make sense. But the reality is, if we were understanding the feelings of animals, we would understand these mitzvahs. From the animal's viewpoint, it makes sense. From the plant's viewpoint, it makes sense. From the order of the creation, it makes sense. We don't get it because we don't intuit those things. Man to man, we intuit, we understand what something is uncomfortable to us, don't do it to somebody else. Something's uncomfortable to the animal, don't do it to the animal. What bothers an animal? I don't know. What bothers a tree? I don't know. So that's how he understands. So he's in the beginning of the section, it says, Chukim are laws of righteousness towards those beings which are subordinate to man, towards earth, plant, animal, one's body, mind, spirit, and word. Now, these are laws of righteousness, which means that they deserve it. It's their right to claim this against us. So Rav Hirsch, in this section over here, in his primary work, now it's written in archaic English. It was written actually in German. And so the syntax is the German syntax. You know, the famous joke about the fellow who came to the speech and left after half an hour and he said, you can't leave yet. They didn't get to the verb. So that's how it reads. So when they translated it from the German, they translated it following that, the syntax, which is like that. So I'm not going to read it inside, but if you take a look at what he says over here, he says a fascinating idea that you understand that the Baal Tashas is the message that the world doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the one who made it, to God. And then he says a fascinating idea. So I'm looking at page 11. So at the end of that paragraph on the top of the page, the last sentence. With this call, with this proclamation, does he represent the greatest and smallest against you? God is the lawyer of the world. He's representing the lawyer in court against you, man. Man is going to come in, powerful, take over the world, do whatever they want with the world. And God says, no, I'm representing the other side. I'm the advocate for the animals. So if you talk about the idea of animal rights, being an advocate for animal rights, God was the first advocate for animal rights. And this was written in the 1870s. So it wasn't like animal rights was like a major thing yet in those times. He says, this is the idea. He says, he's representing the greatest and smallest against you and grants the smallest is also the greatest a right against your presumptuousness. You think you're man, you're powerful, you can do whatever you want. That's not true. So God is representing them against you. Fascinating language. I think it's a beautiful language. This idea, picture that God is coming in the Torah and saying, it's not yours. You don't have the right to do whatever you want with it. He goes further, in the next paragraph, paragraph number 398, which is on page 11, he elucidates a statement in the Talmud based on this. The statement of the Talmud says a person who wantonly destroys clothing or destroys vessels, he takes plates, throws them, and breaks them, he's considered the equivalent of an idolater, a person who's serving idols, idol worship. Says, what's the connection between breaking, tearing clothing in anger and idol worship? What's the connection? Says, the idol worshiper doesn't see God as the owner of the world, doesn't see the God running the world. And the person who tears clothing also doesn't see God as the owner of the world. The only one who has a right to destroy is the owner. If I lend you something, you can use it. You can use it, you can use it in many different ways, but you cannot destroy it. It's not yours to destroy. The person who destroys the world He's claiming it really belongs to him. He's on his way to idolatry. He's taken God off of the pedestal. He's not God off of the one in charge. And he's put himself in that place. See, he's the worst idolater that there is. He's not worshiping any idol. He's worshiping man and the power of man. That's what the message of the sage was saying. That's how he understands it. So he understands the message of Balthashkas is, this commandment is, it's not yours. You're a guest here. Please respect the rules. Okay. That's his explanation. One more explanation, then we'll move on. There's no clock in this room. There's a story about a rabbi one time got up. So a person came to visit. He'd never been to a synagogue before, and like everything which they were doing, it was new to him, and he had a person next to him who was explaining what they're doing. You had that experience, yeah? Right? New, you never been there before, and everything, why are they doing that? You know, what does that mean? What does that represent? What does it symbolize? The rabbi gets up to speak, and he takes off his watch, and he puts it down, and says, what does that mean? He says, that means nothing. Oh, come on, please. Thank you. Okay. So on page 14 and 15, there's an idea over here, which is from a totally different angle. So this is the page 14, this source. I didn't have an English version of it. This is known as Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer. Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer was written by one of the Tanoim. This is from the time of the Mishnah. The Mishnah was final redaction of the Mishnah was of the year 200 of the Common Era, almost right. So it's over 1800 years ago. He was actually generations before that. That was redacted by a person named Rabbi Ben Okadish, Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. Rabbi Yehuda Nasi's father was Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. His father was Rabbi Gamliel. And Rabbi Gamliel was a contemporary of this Rabbi Eliezer. So it's three generations before that. So this is about 1900 years ago. And he wrote, besides what we have quoted from him in the Talmud, we also have a separate medrash called this collection of his different thoughts. And he tells us the following. He says that there are six situations where there's a cry. It's a primordial cry which is heard from one end of the world to the other, but nobody seems to hear it. One of them is when a person passes away. There is that scream of the neshama leaving the body. It's just nobody hears it. But then it says, one of them is v'shosha karsin as an eitz ha'ilam, when you cut down the tree. There's a scream. A fruit tree. A kol yotzim yosef erlam atzoyfa ben a kol nishma. The tree is screaming and nobody hears it. And equates the cutting down of a tree to the death of a person. So, based on that, the Tzora Mor was one of the people who was actually there in the time of the expulsion from Spain in 1492. He was one of the rabbis at that time. He left Spain with the Jews. And he wrote this work on the Bible called Tzora Mor. And he says, the reason why the Torah prohibits cutting down trees is because the tree feels pain when you cut it down. That's his understanding. So we've seen, at this point in time, we've seen one explanation, which seems to be the problem, is the idea of appreciating the value of things. We saw an explanation which came along and said that everything was given to you, was given to you for a purpose, you can't waste anything. We saw an explanation which says that the idea is, you understand that you're a guest here in this world, and you have no right to just use things wantonly. We see an explanation which now says that the issue is that there's actual pain involved in the act of cutting down a tree. Now, if we think about these, trying to project these forward into applications, so how will they play out now with do I have to get over leftovers? So the issue is, I'm a steward, I'm a guest here in the world, I shouldn't waste things. So an act of actively destroying something and hurting something maybe is a problem. Passively, I'm not going to have any leftovers. Do I have any leftovers? If this is not wasting value, it's wasting value. If this is cutting down trees because they're in pain, my leftovers aren't in pain, I hope, right? Please eat me, right? There are certain things when you walk by the refrigerator, they scream out, please eat me, right? You hear them talking to you. But the leftovers usually aren't the ones who would say that, right? They don't say, please eat me, right? So based on how we're seeing what the logic behind the commandment is, that's going to affect how we extrapolate and we project forward to other scenarios to apply it practically. Okay, at this point in time, I'm taking a drink. I'll take one or two questions. Wow, I was so clear. Yes.
So this is only about the fruit tree, right? The fruit tree is only one crying out when we kill it.
This last thought. It only says by fruit trees. Yes, it doesn't say. Well, animals also. Well, animals is a different question. But animals is one of them also.
Other trees don't cry out.
Other trees don't cry out. It says that's what it says. I didn't write it. Yes.
So it talks about obviously creating siege weapons. Talking about offense. If you're on kind of more of a defensive, where you're the one scorching the earth to deprive an attacking army of their food, and basically trying to starve them out to break a siege. Is that allowed?
That would be allowed. Yes, theoretically, that would be allowed. If that's going to protect the people, that would be a form of protection. So that would be my understanding. That would be allowed because if the purpose is to protect us from the attack by causing the marauding army to not have the resources to stick around for too long. Okay, hold it. Yeah, you remember it?
Yeah.
Okay. What time was it? 10 minutes. Okay. Now the Gemara comes along that the Gemara wants, and the Gemara, which is the Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah, which comes with the written Torah, and says, you know, there's a lot more to the story. Even in the written verse itself, there's more to the story. The words of the verse seem to include more as well. So this is from the Talmud, pages 16 and 17 is from the Talmud. So 17 gives you the English version of it, and the Talmud extrapolates, you cannot wantonly destroy even a non-fruit-bearing tree. It's not limited to a fruit-bearing tree, it's even a non-fruit-bearing tree. So then the Gemara then asks, so then why does the Torah mention specifically the fruit-bearing tree? It's because if you have a conflict between the two, you need one of them, you should choose the non-fruit-bearing tree rather than the fruit-bearing tree. But if Then the Gemara takes it a step further and says, well, what about if the value of the non-fruit-bearing tree is greater than the value of the fruit-bearing tree? So which one should you cut down? You need to cut one of them. All right? In this situation, they're creating a siege. They need... It was a valid war, justified war. We discussed this situation. They have a right to do it. We need to cut down a tree. This is part of what we need to do to accomplish our objective over here, which is a valid objective. We have a choice between the fruit-bearing tree and the non-fruit-bearing tree. So we say normally we choose the fruit, we cut down the non-fruit-bearing tree because the fruit-bearing tree also adds fruit to the world. Let's say the value is flipped around. The non-fruit-bearing tree is this very, very expensive wood, very, very valuable wood, right? And the fruit-bearing tree is a tree which doesn't really produce too much fruits. It's not a fruit which is normally eaten so much. What do you do? So it says, I would think, it could be thought, that the precedence of non-fruit trees over fruit trees applies even if the fruit tree is more valuable as timber than for its fruits. So the Torah says the word rak. Rak is always a limitation. That precedence is not absolute. It depends. We have to measure. We have to measure which one's more valuable. So in a scenario where the value of timber would be greater than the value of fruit, we're allowed to do that. Now, there's pain over here. There's animal rights over here. But there's also human rights. And we have to find the balance between the two of them. And so far we're making this very nice, very easy, very simple formula. But the problem is the world is complex. The world is not easy. We're balancing different needs over here. We need to wage a war. It was a valid reason to go to war. Defensive war that it was, but we're doing this as a preemptive war. Right? 1967, preemptive strike. If they waited too late, we wouldn't be here talking to yourselves, right? Preemptive strike is sometimes the correct thing to do. And that was decided by the Sanhedrin and the high court and by the high priest, etc., etc. But you're cutting down trees. So if tree is an absolute value, there's no other precedence. The Bible says not like that. We're going to allow to balance different needs. So then the Gemara gives two examples of that, which I'm not going to read right now, but introduces this idea that we recognize the fact that it's not so simple. So I gave you an addendum, which the next three pages are from a quote from a work of Responsa. So, known in Hebrew as shamus and chuvas, responsive means when a person would address a question to a rabbi, written usually, he would respond by writing an answer along with the logic why that argument is true. It's like the same way the judge would write a brief after the court case explaining the decision. That's called he's responding. So these collections were known as responsive. So responsive, plural, responsive, singular. So this was written by a person named Rav Moshe Sofer. Rav Moshe Sofer was also known as the Chassam Sofer. He was the leading rabbi in Austria-Hungary in his time. He passed away at the beginning of the 1800s, the 19th century. Passed away in 1839, it says over there. He wrote it. We have an extensive collection of his works, which he actually published a large amount himself. His children published as well. And he was addressing the question, am I allowed to cut down a fruit tree to build a building? Jews were kept in very, very cramped quarters. Very limited area that was allowed for the Jews to live. There's very limited area for the Jews to live. And we need a place for people to live. Can I cut down a fruit tree for that purpose? That was the question which he's addressing. I gave you an English translation of it together with some explanation of it. I apologize for the size of the font. I was thinking about giving magnifying glasses out also. But I have stock in an eyeglass company. So hopefully you'll go to the doctor and you get new eyeglasses. Never waste resources, right? You spend it, I get it, right? Okay. So he introduces an idea, and this is what this addendum points out. Introduces an idea that even if you're going to need the space, which is a valid need, if you can uproot the tree and replant it somewhere else, you must do so. Number one, there's a business of people who do this. Right? They uproot trees in a way that they're viable. They're going to be able to flourish in a new place. There's enough of a root ball with them that you can, even very large trees, obviously you need large equipment. People make a livelihood out of this. That's the first point. The second point, he says, this decision that you have a right to do this, it has to be compelling. When in doubt, you can't uproot. So in that addendum over there, which I gave you, so they quote a Rabbi Shabti Rappaport, is a rabbi in Israel, which he says he feels that the message of this responsa from the Chassam Sofer is that trees have rights. Trees have rights to be in their place. Trees have rights to exist. You have other. We balance human rights against that as well. But it has to be a compelling, valid human right. The last example which we have over here in your booklet, which was from Rabbi Shimon Sofer, pages 22 and 23, with a grandson of the Chassam Sofer, addresses a question about time. Yes, I could save resources. Yes, I could save the tree. Yes, I could save the money. It's going to take a lot of time. Right? The reason why we have so much waste is because it's time saving. It's easier to use the disposable as opposed to washing the dishes. It's easier to eat out and instead of heating up the leftovers. I mean, well, that's a good argument. Yes or no, you'll decide what mood you're in, right? So, what about time? Time is also a resource. Time is money. So you're saying, I have a right to balance the two. So maybe time is also balance. And then he says a fascinating idea. What's the purpose of time? To use it wisely. Maybe spending the time to save the resources and not waste something is a valid use of time. So it's not a waste of time. That's a bad way of saying it. That's a good use of time. Yes, it's more time to wash the dishes than to use the disposable, but that's what time was given for, is to use it for good ideological needs, ideological purposes, and that's what he stands with the question. He stands with the question. Okay, so let's just try and maybe touch on a few things that we mentioned at the beginning. Leftovers, okay? Do you have to eat leftovers instead of throwing them out. What do you say? Don't be scared. Whatever you say is right. Because we're saying that, yes. So who says no?
I'm going to say it depends.
Say it depends. Okay, that's a good Jewish answer. Right? The correct Jewish answer is it's a disagreement. Come on. Right? My father would learn for many years whenever he would ask me a halacha question, I'd say, well, Daddy, it's a disagreement between two opinions.
I disagree.
You think it's not a disagreement? Thank you. Okay. So, based on what we're saying, it's money, it's valuable, don't waste it. You're not damaging something actively, so maybe that's not a problem. Can I just let it sit in my fridge till finally it's going to take up space and smelly and I can throw it out? Should I do that? It would seem to be what we're saying, that really, preferably, a person should try and reuse things and not waste them. And that's the Torah message, is to try and do that. Should I spend time on trying to recycle, to conserve, etc.? It means more work? Yes. The answer seems to be pretty much yes. That's what the Rabbi Shimon Shofar was talking about at the end. The last response says, that's a valid use of time, is to do that. Do I need to spend money in that? Now we're getting to an interesting question, because it's resources versus resources. Money is a resource. Money has value. And this also has value. So what should you do? That's not a clear of a question. But the Chassam Sofer said, we quoted this response of the Chassam Sofer, he says that trees have rights. And you have to it has to be a compelling reason why you're doing it. So how much money? What's a compelling reason? It's a hard question. I don't have a good answer to that question. And it's a case-by-case basis that we're going to answer those questions. Okay. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.